Hello, good morning. It's Abbey 104 on Sunday morning. It's 6 minutes past 11, and that means it's time for Folktales. I'm Terry Bennett, and in the studio today I have Bonnie Sartin. Good morning, Bonnie.
Good morning. Good morning, one and all.
Yeah. Hello. Bonnie, you are the main man, or the lead front man behind the Yetis.
Yeah, well, I was the lead singer, I guess, yes. Really, but I wouldn't say I'm just, you know, I did all the background work, the finances and all those sort of things, and but it was a living for 46 years, so just something right.
Tell us about the Yetis. Okay. I mean, a lot of people will know a bit about them, but just tell us.
Yeah. We met in the Scouts in Yetminster, would you believe, and then the WI. Bless them, they started folk dance lessons every other Tuesday night in Yetminster Village Hall, you see. And the young girls from the village, lovely they were too, went to join in. And where the young girls go, the boys naturally follow. And we discovered this folk dancing was a contact sport, you know. You cuddle the girls without getting your hand slapped. And we formed a team to do displays of these old Dorset dances around the local area. And we were the Yetminster and Ryman Trinsicker Junior Folk Dance Display Team. Snappy little title.
See why you shortened it.
Yeah, well, we didn't, but somebody else said, oh, God, call them the Yetis, and that's it, and it stuck. And we lived with that for 50 years, you know, so it obviously worked, didn't it?
And the Yetis were a very successful group, and as you say, it went on for quite a number of years up until, was it 2010? You decided
2011, where, 2011. Yeah, and we had a final fling here in Sherborne.
Yeah.
We had a knees up on the Friday night and a concert on the Saturday night. And then on the Sunday, we invited everybody in for a cup of tea and a Dorset apple cake and had a good chin wag. And that was it. Yeah.
Call it a day. But in the interim period, you had 55 albums, is that right?
Yeah, I did count the other day. I think it's 51. And then I thought, no, there's a couple more there, because he did some music on the backgrounds of some readings. And then I've done three of my own CDs. So, yeah, it's getting up there. Yeah.
And some interesting associations with Thomas Hardy and really the local community, really, when it's what you're based upon.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what a lovely place, you know, to... I mean, a lot of the songs of Dorset, the old songs were collected from my family, so there's always that association. But the Thomas Hardy, of course, fine fiddle player, not people alone to this, but he was a good violinist, following in his father's footsteps, really. And he used to play for dances around the area when he was 12 years old, on his own. And, of course, a lot of his books and his poems, musicians crop up. So, you know, we borrowed his fiddle and his father's fiddle from Dorset County Museum and did a double CD recording of readings from Hardy about the musicians and bits of music that he used to play. A lovely, lovely project. Yeah, one of those things I'm very proud of, actually.
And the Yetis were not just a Dorset-based folk group. You went all over the world in your time, didn't you?
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's easy to turn these things down, but you get these offers and you think, oh, that would be intriguing, wouldn't it? You know, we started going abroad to the forces bases in Germany back in the early 70s. And then we sort of spread our wings a bit, and we had offers from an organisation called the British Council. And they rang us up and said, would the Yetis like to go to Nepal? And we thought, April Fool's Day, isn't it? You know, Yetis in Nepal, haven't they got enough already up in the mountains? But they were serious, and they kept ringing up and saying, well, make the tour a bit longer, because we got Pakistan interested, and then it was Sri Lanka. And in fact, in the end, it was 7 countries in 7 weeks, you know, a whirlwind tour. But, you know, we went back and did several of those, actually, over the years in Africa and what have you. Absolutely fascinating.
All right, we'll come back and talk a little more about that in due course, but as we always do, we'll have a wander through your life. But before all that, let's take your first track. This is Nina Simone.
Yeah. I mean, this song, she sings it so beautifully, a wonderful, wonderful voice. And this reminds me, we turned professional, what we laughingly call professional, in October 67. And our first tour was down in Devon. And there I was on a Monday morning, on a beach, swanning around, and I still can feel it inside. Yes, freedom.
We've arrived. Nina Simone and Feeling Good.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean? Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world, and a bold world for me. When you shine, you know how I feel. Scent of the pine, you know how I feel. Oh, freedom is mine, and I know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me.
Nina Simone there, and Feeling Good from 1965, first written for the
stuff.
Roar of the grease paint and the smell of the crowd from that particular music.
Can I just say a bit about Abbey FM, because I come into Walsall here and you're swapping over from one programme to the next, and I've been a lot of radio studios over the years, and there's always an element of panic about, plugging this, plugging in that, picking up that, moving that. And you did it so calmly. I'm full of admiration. It's very professional, actually.
Oh, thank you very much. We should also mention that you do have an official capacity with Abbey, don't you?
I'm a director, but it doesn't mean I do very much, to be honest with you. It's just a name on a bit of paper, isn't it?
Anyway, in the studio, as you look at, this is Bonnie Sartin of the Yetis fame. And we just had a quick word there, Bonnie, didn't we, about who the Yetis were and some of the stuff you got up to. But let's go back in time and talk about your early life. And I'm imagining this all took place in Dorset. You were born in Dorset.
Yeah, my family have been around Dorset for over 350 years, so we're almost accepted, you know. We got a foot in the door anyway. And, my father came from Bradford Abbas and my mother came from Thornford. And when they started courting, because my dad was a bit of a laddo, really, the worthies of Thornford actually got a deputation together, went and knocked on my grandmother's door and said, "You can't let that daughter go out with that nice daughter go out with that irk from Bradford Abbas." You know, his great crime was to climb up the tower where the clock is in Thornford and move the hands on an hour. Oh, they knew we'd done it. That was that Jack Sarton, you see. And that was a black mark, definitely a big black mark against him.
So not the type of person that you wanted your daughter to associate with.
No. So my grandmother ran the coffee tavern in Thornford when it was a coffee tavern. Mm-hmm. And her husband came back after the First War completely shattered, you know, physically. I mean, he never worked again, all of a shake and everything. So she ran that. And the vicar used to come down there and teach the boys boxing, keep them off the streets, you know, that would do them no damage at all. It's much better to be boxing than on the streets, you know.
But you were born in the locality, and one of many, or were you...
I was the last of four. I got a twin sister, older twin sister, and a brother who's 2 years older, and a sister who's six years older. And I was born, actually, in a little cottage between Sherborne and Thornford, as you go up the hill past the dairy there on the left-hand side, cottages. Yeah. During the war, of course, this was, and no electricity, water from the well, you know, privy at the bottom of the garden. Mm-hmm. Very primitive, really, but we survived, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was always the countryside out there to raid for food, which we did a lot of, and still do.
Mother and father occupations?
Yeah, well, Mum, obviously, when you got married you sat around. Yeah, she was in service of various places, houses around here. Yeah. And Dad was a bricklayer by trade. But he was in charge of things like building the reservoir at the top of Honeycomb Tout here in Sherborne. Okay. And he's dab a hand with the old reinforced concrete.
Happy memories of those days?
Yeah, I think so. It was a rough old upbringing, really, but it's some good stead, really, and... kept us fit because we worked hard and we cycled everywhere, of course. And I still do. Well, not everywhere, but I do quite a lot of cycling. So, it was good. And Thornford School, academy for young Irks out there in Thornford, 36 pupils, that's all it was. And it was a small room in a big room. And, ideal, really, isn't it? And then off to into Sherborne to the foster school, your grammar school.
So tell us about school days in Thornford then. That must have been a lot different than it would be now.
Oh, yeah. Well, the lady who ran the small room, Nellie Ruiker was, her name was, she lived here in Sherborne, actually. And she didn't have any qualifications, but, you know, she taught us. And we learnt to paint rainbows and things like that. Really useful things. And she, I always remember, she had a sort of mopedy thing with a motor in the back wheel to get from Thornford to Sherborne and back. And when you got to a certain height, you were allowed to push her off because she had to start down the hill past the school. So it was three of us, you know, one on each cheek and someone pushing the back, pushing her down the road to go, and off went this little thing. Oh, yeah. And we used to sing... Glory, glory, hallelujah. Nelly's been and hit me with a ruler.
Shades of the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So, good days then, but the time came when you had to move on to Foster's in Sherborne.
Sure,
many people will remember that.
And yes. Probably less said the better, I think, really.
Okay, so not not one of your...
I was all right at the sports, I was good at the sports.
Yeah, okay, but you weren't a great fan of the academia.
What's that?
So you were a sporting individual.
Yeah.
Did music come in the early days?
No, it didn't really, because the chap who took the music lessons and had got us singing listened to me doing the do, re, fa, mi, whatever you do, and said, oh, you can't sing, go and sit in the groaners and bring a book next time. So I never sang in school.
It was ironic, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. I know who had the last laugh in the end. And also, of course, they tried to knock the Dorset accent out of me. There again, I knew I had the last laugh. So, it's strange, really.
So looking back on Foster, then, you wouldn't have too many happy memories of
not
that?
Not really. Some of the teachers were really, very nice, really. And there's one or two of them were good teachers, but most of them, you know, they were dealing with a bunch of lads, and we didn't learn a lot, you know. The Foster School, when it was knocked down, was a lot of it went down to Trent Path Lane to fill up the ruts and things down there, and I've cycled over that quite a few times.
With some glee.
Yeah. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Okay, and so academically you were just sort of middle of the road then, were you? And,
Yeah. I didn't really start to learn till I left school, to be honest with you, and started reading a lot of books and
did you have
getting
any
involved in music.
Early ideas what you wanted to do at school? Was there a career path carved out for you?
Or? Our scoutmaster was a printer. He ran a printing works, and he said, oh, come and do an apprenticeship. So, fine. okay, off I went. Mm. And I did a 5-year printers compositors apprenticeship, which there's not a lot of them about now.
Probably not.
And then I did 2 years here in Saltells with a printer firm in Saltells, which is actually owned by the girls' school now. Yeah. But if you cycle past, if you go past it, you'll see the doors have still got the big Saltells logo on it, you know.
Yeah.
I did 2 years there. And lovely blokes to work with. There's still one or two about I chat to now. It was a nice place to work, but there was nothing to touch going on the road and feeling, like Nina Simone, that freedom, you know. I mean, that was really quite something.
So leaving school at 16 then, presumably, you didn't have any great ambition to do anything particular, just whatever came along?
No, the whole thing just sort of grew, you know. Yeah. We started singing a few songs and going to folk song clubs in the area, which were popping up all over the place.
So you say we. How did it actually start?
Then? Bob Common, who actually now lives in Sherborne, Pete Shuttler, Mac McCulloch and myself, the four of us, and we were just lads having our fun. I was transport manager because I had a 1933 Ford 8 called Desdemona, right? Fine old bus. And you just go off and do things. When we got bookings further afield, which occasionally happened these days, we would hire a big old Vauxhall from the chap who was a signalman at Yeovil Junction. His little spare time activity was a bit of taxi work and hiring at these big old Vauxhall Veloxes for 10 shillings a day, 50 pence for them that don't know. And so we'd go roaring off country, but they were always breaking down. We got stuck on Salisbury Plain overnight. We got hit all over the place. And people had said to us, we ran a folk song club in Yeovil starting in 1963. And people who came there as guests said, you ought to go professional, you boys, you know. And we thought, mug's game. But in the end...
Fundamentally, and you just started as a group of mates and who enjoyed singing.
Enjoyed the music,
And sure. you did that where? Before the folk club?
Yeah, before... Well, folk clubs, there's one in Dorchester, one in Weymouth, one in Taunton.
So you just went round various venues and just enjoyed joined
ourselves.
In. Yeah.
And the other three played in a band. Yeah. As well for folk dancing, and then occasionally get up and sing a song there. I kept dancing because I let the cuddling bit. and it just gradually grew on us. And in the end, you know, we were working out, we were trying to hold jobs down and also working most nights doing bits and pieces. So we said, well, something's got to go. Mm-hmm. So we said, for 3 months, we'll turn professional. And we got offers from folk song clubs all over the country. And also, it took off. Can I just read you a bit from my diary?
Yeah, go on.
This is 6 months after we turned professional. And this is the itinerary for May 1968, okay? 1st of May, Minehead. 2nd, Sheffield. 3rd, Sheffield. 4th, Rossendale. 5th, Bolton. 6th, Barnsley. 7th, Newark. 8th, Huddersfield. 9th, Stafford. 10th, Stoke-on-Trent. Sheffield on the 11th again. Hull on the 12th. Day off. Cleethorpes, Accrington, Burnley, Walsall, Walthamstow, and then back home for a couple of days and back up to Warwickshire and places around there. So we didn't go mad with the money. We paid ourselves £8 a week each. That was our spending money. Mm-hmm. Okay, and yet he's, you know, bought the transport and paid for the food and things. But it was a giggle. And it was great fun. Okay. Kipping on floors. You know, if you got a bed, that was a real luxury. But, you know, just young blokes having a good time.
We'll explore how that then became... what it did become, the fully fledged Yetis group. But let's have your next piece of music. This is John Williamson, and I'm on in the Mood.
Yeah, John writes some lovely songs, and he's an Australian, and I just love his stuff, you know. And a friend over there sends me these CDs occasionally. Yeah, so it's a nice cuddly tune.
Okay.
I'm not in the mood for laughing, and I'm not in the mood for blues. I'm not in the mood for gambling, 'cause I'm not in the mood to lose. I'm in the mood for staying home and kicking off my shoes. And I'm in the mood for loving, and I love you. I'm not in the mood for a party or watching a video, but I'm in the mood for music as long as it's way down low. Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow? Hey, I'm in the mood for making love to you. Yeah, I'm in the mood for making. I'm in the mood for making. I'm in the mood for making love to you. Not in the mood for smoking or drinking a bottle of beer, but I'm in the mood for whispering sweet nothings in your ear. Hey there, you with that melting smile, bring your body over here. Hey, I'm in the mood for making love to you. Yeah, I'm in the mood.
John Williamson there, and I'm in the Mood, a track from 1987 from his Mallee Boy album. And I think that's something to do with the fact that he was born in that area of Australia. Is that right, Bob?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and he's obviously done very well known over there and tours Australia. And he writes songs about the life of the Australian people in the outback and what have you. And yeah, it's good stuff. It's good stuff.
In the studio this morning, it's Bonnie Sartin, he of Yeti's fame. And Bonnie, we've talked about your early life and how, as a group of friends, basically, you went together singing in various folk clubs around the locality. And eventually you took a decision that you would go professional. Well, that must have been a bit of a leap of faith.
It was a leap of faith, really. You know, the place I worked for, bless them, they kept my job open for 3 months, thinking I'd be back. And as I described earlier on, that actually life just took off. There's so many folks, hundreds and hundreds of folk song clubs all over the country. And we had a little taste of, you know, what it was like. There was a chap, it's 1965 this is, before we turned professional, in London. And a BBC producer wanted to do a folk programme, a live one. And he'd heard about these singers from Dorset and he was determined to book us. Well, none of us were on the phone back then. So what he did, he persevered. He rang the phone box in Yetminster. And the Reverend Widdicombe was passing, answered the phone, took the message, gave it to the publican of the White Hart. And he passed, when we went in there for a pint, he passed on to us and we put our fourpence in the slot and rang London, got our first very nerve-wracking radio programme for the BBC that way. We also done a couple television programmes for TSW, folky-type programmes. So, you know, we had a touch of it. And it obviously enjoyed ourselves.
Yeah.
So it was great when all this work started rolling in from all over the country, and because you meet some lovely people, you know. And we go and do a folk song club and they'd say, because you never pay for accommodation, they say, oh, you're staying with us tonight. Well, four blokes they'd never met before invite them in the house, you know, and OK, you're over there, keep in here, whatever. And in the morning they say, we've got to go off to work, so we'll leave you to do your breakfast and lock up as you go. Well, how trusting is that? Mm-hmm. And when we go back in the next year, they say, cool, you're domesticated. You actually washed up before you went, you know. So very small beginnings. But there's folk song club we ran in Yeovil. We had people like Paul Simon there, who was touring over here just before his records took off in the States. And he was very good. His fee was £7, but we paid him 10 because we thought he was good. All right. Well, he was good. He was very good. Julie Felix came, a name. She's still over here, actually. She came over to work a little while. I didn't have a work permit. So she married the chap who ran Dorchester Folk Song Club so she could stay. And she's still here. And I don't know. We made a lot of friends that way. And that's, you know, well, our name spread around the country, I suppose.
I have a feeling you wouldn't get Paul Simon for £7 these days.
Probably not. Not even for old time's sake. No.
All right. So tell us then, you took a decision then to go professional. And how did you sort of get your name out there? Or was that already, was that just a self-generating process, but you were already known?
It was all, well, it was to a certain extent that people had visited our club, you know, spread the word. But I guess there was a chap in Sheffield who organised a run of 14 bookings for us up there. And then it's amazing how the old grapevine works, you know. And so it was non-stop. And we did that for about 3 years. And in the end, of course, you know, we're driving around in lovely old Humbers, but, you know, before the motorways went in, most of them, and we're doing lots of miles. The Green Shield stamps were fantastic. We could fill a book a week, you know. but we were getting shattered again, you know, and something had to give. So, and we got a letter from a chap called Jim Lloyd, who was the front man for all the folk programmes on Radio 2. And he said, I'm getting loads of letters about you chaps and you're just working too hard for too little money. Before long, you'll have to give up because you'll be too tired. Absolutely spot on. And he said, if you let me be your manager, I will, you know, get you into theatres. And he said, I'll make you rich beyond your wildest dreams. Well, we were with him for 13 years and he's very good, actually. But when we finally parted company, quite amicably, he said, there you are, I made you solvent beyond your wildest dreams.
He changed subtly over those 13 years.
Yeah. He still remembers that. He lives in Australia now. He's still in touch occasionally. But yeah, we got started getting lots more radio work and recording contracts for Argo, part of the Decca setup. And
so when was your first record? When did
the first LP was in 1968. For a little company in Oxfordshire, we did another one for them, and then we got involved with Argo, and we did, I guess, about 14 albums for them.
And demand for that came off the back of your popularity around the
And the radio work and television work we're getting. We used to do multicolour swap shop on a Saturday morning for Cheggers with Cheggers and all that, usually in some freezing park in London with lots of screaming kids. The best one of those actually was in Television Centre. And it was Christmas time, and the other guests were Cliff Richard and Twiggy. And we finished up singing carols together, which was lovely. Yeah. They wouldn't do it these days, but we all got in together, and it was really, really nice. Yeah.
And so you took on the manager then, in the end?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we signed up to Jim, and he's a rather trained actor. Right. And so for us to go into theatre and know what to do with the lights and the sound equipment was a big step. And also to do a two-hour show instead of a half-hour slot, you know. So he's a very good director and ideas of how we could produce what we were turning out and make it more, I guess, it was a family show, you know. So, you know, that needed doctoring a little bit, should we say, with some of the words and what have you. But which would be okay in a folk song club, but not to young kids.
Sure.
And I began writing bits and pieces as well, and loads of songs. People kept sending us songs to sing. And also, of course, there's a wealth of material here in Dorset, you know.
Well, I was going to ask you about the material, because folk songs have been around since the year dot, haven't they?
Well, nobody knows when, to be honest with you.
But so you had plenty of material to start with, but you also wrote some of your own and adapted others, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and we would arrange and adapt other songs. And I started writing, I suppose, perhaps the 70s. We did a whole series on television. Do you remember It's a Knockout? You must remember It's a Knockout on the telly, right? Well, the BBC in their wisdom decided to have a young farmer's version. And they got teams of young farmers from Cornwall in East Anglia and Scotland and what have you to compete. And they had things like combine harvester driving, racing, you know, around the fields. Well, they loved it, didn't they? And we were booked to do a bit of the judging and sing a song each week. And Ted Moult was the other judge. And Lance Percival, who went to school here in Sherborne, he was the city idiot. So we had to explain things to Lance. And in doing that, explain things to the people down the other end of the tube, you see.
Yes.
And there was one particular programme where they wanted to talk about changes in the countryside, in particular scarecrows, because they were disappearing. And they said, have you got a scarecrow song? We said, no. And they said, we don't either. And I said, well, hang about, I'll see what I can do. And I wrote a little song about scarecrows, which and they offered me a job writing songs for the BBC after that. So it was really, really nice. I didn't do it because I was too busy with the band. But, yeah.
And you did a lot of, as you say, radio work and TV work. You mentioned before Pete Murray's Open House, which people of a certain age will remember. And other TV programmes you got involved with? You mentioned Swap Shop and...
Yeah, oh, double, what's the top one with of the pops, Double or Drop? No, we didn't get on Top of the Pops. No, we didn't get on there. We did get in the charts for the couple tracks, but our main thing was LPs.
Yes.
You know, we sold loads and loads of LPs. Yeah. And I've got a nice gold disc to hang on the wall.
And that was 74, was it?
76, 77, something like that, yeah.
And that was for what, one particular
it
album?
It was one called Upmarket, And,
and you were producing albums quite regularly at that point.
Oh, yeah, two a year. We had a contract for doing two a year with Decca.
Yeah.
We had a lovely party here in Sherborne, even before the Sherborne Hotel was a Trust House 40 place, and they invited all the national press down for this big bash, a whole weekend. So we took them around Dorset and Old Coach and wined them and dined them, had a knees up in Yetminster Village Hall. Bob Arnold, Tom Forrest of the Archers, came down to present the gold disc because we worked with him quite a bit. I did an LP with him in 1974. And it was a lovely time. It was had by all, really. The only unfortunate thing was that all the papers gave us a really nice write-up, except for one reporter who'd always been cornered by my father. So he got a little bit about the Yetis in the corner of the page and half a page about my father's poaching activities.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, embarrassing. I laugh now, but yes, at the time.
OK, well, let's take your next track and then we'll come back and talk about some of your tours abroad and how it all progressed from there. This is actually... Yeti's track, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, this is William Barnes' job, is it, this one? Yeah, it. Well, William. Everybody knows Lyndon Lee, because William Barnes wrote it and Vaughan Williams set it to music. Beautiful, beautiful tune. But that set off a bit of a trend for putting his stuff to music. And, of course, lovely. Lyndon Lee originally was written in the broad Dorset dialect, as most of his poems were. And this is one, it's called The Stagecoach, which we set to music, which... It's a lovely bouncy thing, and you can just imagine the wind whistling past their ears as they drive around the countryside in this old stagecoach.
Okay, it's the Yetis in the Stagecoach.
Ah, when the old folk went abroad, they thought it fast enough. If Morgan passes hit the road, up for the coach's roof. And there they sat, a conder rot and rolled along the ground. All the whip did smack on the horse's back, and the wheels went swiftly round. Good souls, the wheels went swiftly round. No iron rails did streak the land to keep the wheels in track. The coachman turned his fore and hand out right to left and back. And he stopped before a man's own door to take an upper round. For the reins fell slack on the horse's back till the wheels did rattle round again. Till the wheels did rattle round. There when wintry wind did blow athwart the plain and hill, and the sun were pale above the snow, and ice did stop the mill. They did laugh and joke, we coat our cloaks so warmly round and bound, while the whip did crack on the horse's back, and the wheels did trundle round. Do you know, the wheels did trundle round. And when the rumbling coach did pass, where the hufflin' winds did roar, they'd stop to take a warning glass, be the sign about the door. And it'd laugh and joke, and ask the folk, the miles they were from town, till the whip did crack on the horse's back, and the wheels did chuckle round. Good folk, the wheels did chuckle round. Gaily rode old age or youth when summer light did fall, on woods and leaf or trees and blue or dirt folks' parkside wall. And they thought they'd pass the places fast along the dusty ground, when the whip did smack on the horse's back and the wheels spun swiftly round. Them days the wheels spun swiftly round.
That That's the Yetis and the Stagecoach, as chosen by Bonnie Sarton, who was quite mixed up with the Yetis for a while, weren't you, Bonnie?
Mixed up is about right. Yeah. No, that track is lovely. I love that song. I still sing it. You know,
lovely. Isn't it?
No, it's great.
Anyway, yeah. Bonnie, we got to the point where you're riding high, really, aren't you? This album's coming to a year, and you're on the television, and you're on radio programmes, and doing really well.
Yeah, it was brilliant timing because we were all thinking of settling down and getting married and kids and mortgages and that, so it was absolutely brilliant, you know.
But quite a tiring lifestyle in many ways, though.
Oh, yeah, all over the place, you know, and you flying around, you know, for some of the things, you know, you'd be in Scotland one day and the Channel Islands the next sort of job, you know. So it was tiring, but it was very satisfying. You know, there's nothing like people come asking for your autograph and things like that, you know.
Although
some of the kids bring their sweet papers, you know.
And group of four of you, as it was then, wasn't it?
Yeah,
or was it three?
Well, no, we're down to three by then.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bob left in 1979, at the end of 79.
Yeah. But it's very much not a one-man band, that would be the wrong way of putting it, wouldn't it? But I guess you don't have a whole lot of support. There's not a whole lot of people to help you set up and take down and all the rest of it. You couldn't do a fair amount of it yourself.
No, cottage industries, really. Mm. I mean, if we were working in theatres back then, we used our own equipment.
Yeah.
But we did have our own stuff, and you know, which we carried around with us, which occasionally rescued us because sometimes the theatre stuff is not very good. But we were, I say, you know, definitely cottage industries come the end. But there's a lot of people out there would book us year after year after year. We used to go to Northampton. The final two or three shows of the year were in Northampton for a Christmas sing-along. And we did that for, it's over 30 years we did that, you see. So regular friends out there that booked us, and up in East Anglia and all over the place, really.
You mentioned earlier the involvement with the British Council, which then led to you going on a number of overseas tours, didn't it? How did that come about?
Well, they, unbeknown to us, have been coming to our concerts in the London area, checking us out, really, because it's a bit of a diplomatic job, you understand. You can't, you know. And in the end, they rang up and said, "Would we like to go to Nepal?" And then they stretched it, and you know, it was Pakistan, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, and they said, "Well, we got you Pakistan for four shows in Lahore, but if they like you and you don't offend anybody, we'll have a longer tour next year." But the whole thing was a bit of a fiasco to start with, because we left here on the train with a huge flight case with two guitars, two accordions, all our instruments and costumes in there. We had Nelly, the only Morris dancing elephant in captivity, in there. I was the front, Mac was the back. And we set off to Heathrow, and of course got to the counter there, checking in on a Japan Airlines flight. And of course this flight case, far, far too big to go on the usual luggage jobby carousel thing. So that disappears, and we pile on the plane, and it's a stopper. Stops in Rome, stops in Abu Dhabi, and eventually we arrive in Delhi Airport, where we had to change flights. And we get off the plane, hand luggage comes off the plane, flight case nowhere to be seen. And they all say, "No, there's nothing like that on the plane," because you don't know whether it's left Heathrow, dropped off at Cairo, back, whatever, you know. Panic sets in, doesn't it? And so in the end, all we could do was queue up for our flight to Kathmandu, you see. Got to the front of the queue, and the chap said, "Oh, no, it's gone." "What, excuse me? No, I got it." "Ah, yeah, but there's enough people on board, so we sent it on." So we had another 4-hour wait to get on an Air India flight, and flying into Kathmandu is quite something, because there are lots of mountains out there, you see. So even in a little Boeing, you have to drop the nose fairly quickly to come in. But we arrived, fear and trepidation, because no instruments, no costumes, no nothing. And so, you know, back in those days, it was telexes going all over the world trying to find this flight case. Meanwhile, we had a show to do. The first show was for the Nepalese scouts in Kathmandu. And we took over some artifacts and things from Baden-Powell House in London, and to do a swap, what have you. But somebody said, "Well, I've got a guitar you can borrow." So we said, yeah, anything. And someone else said, "Well, there's an accordion in the Royal Nepal Academy somewhere tucked away. I think it's brand new. Someone donated it years ago, never been played." Eventually we found this, and of course it played itself, didn't it? So we had to take it apart, put it back together again. Mm-hmm. We went down to the embassy, the British Embassy pantomime department for costumes. And we did the first half of the show like that. And they loved it. They all joined in. They clapped, they cheered, they made chicken noises for a song that we do in, cockerel noises and things. And it was lovely. Then in the interval, down the aisle comes our flight case. They'd found it in a hangar in Tokyo. And bless them, they'd flown it back especially for us. So after that, that was almost a disaster. We thought, what we've been worried about. Mm. They're lovely people. Mm. Let's get on with it. And we settled down and went back to Nepal a year later, actually, and it was like long-lost sons coming home. They couldn't do enough for us. You know, it was absolutely wonderful. And they take you off down to the local television studio, which had just been donated by the Japanese, and they say, come in, we want you to make a television show. And when they said, we'd like you to make a television show, that's what they meant. So we had to line the cameras up and do the whole bit. Right. Can you imagine walking to the BBC and saying, I'm going to make a television show? That's great fun.
And the point of this, from the viewpoint of the British Council, was to profile British culture abroad.
That's right. Mm. It was most people, I think, they think we march around in busbies all the time. You know, this was bringing it down to earth and talking about things we have in common. You know, the agriculture in England, as you know, that you're doing it for the same reason you do it in Nepal or Ethiopia, wherever you happen to be. You know, and we've all got songs and about it and traditions about working in the countryside. So you sit down with one of the local people, talk about their customs, find things you've got in common, and away you go. That's great. And we worked a lot with John Arlott, the cricket commentator, putting his cricket and poems to music for the radio. And you can go into India or Pakistan or Sri Lanka or Bangladesh and mention John Arlott. They know exactly who you're talking about. That voice. Oh, absolutely wonderful.
So you were riding high at that point, and there did come a point, though, where the popularity of folk music and folk clubs started to tail off a little. What point did that come in?
Yeah, I guess it was probably mid-80s. We were doing all this foreign stuff. We were okay. But a lot of the theatres were virtually closing down because of government cutbacks at that time. And I know we went to one theatre and we said, cool, what's going on here then? They said, well, not a lot really, but you're one of the three live shows we've been able to book this year, so count your blessings. Mm-hmm. You know,
I see.
But then we adapted. You know, the manager, we parted company because he wanted to go off and do something else, and people began to ring me for the bookings, so that was fine. And we just set off and did the next year's pottering around the country, doing our thing, bit of radio, bit of TV, whatever, you know. And it was all right. And by that time, I guess, you know, what will we do? There weren't a lot of call for printers, compositors by that time. And there were such lovely people out there, you know. Yeah.
So you carried on doing what you did, and there were still plenty of folk clubs that you could go and tour, and you're doing some recording still at that point?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, actually, folk clubs were... We couldn't make a living in folk song clubs.
Mm.
So we were out doing
recording stuff.
What we could, recordings and doing halls all over the country for different organisations. People who wanted to raise money would book us and pay us our fee, and then ending off the top, obviously, they put into the charity.
Yeah.
So it burbled on, and I have to be very grateful.
Yes.
Thank you very much to all those lovely people out there, really. I've just come down from the car boot in Sherborne. There's a lady there. I used to book you, she said, in Washington, down in Sussex.
Ah.
And she lives in Yetminster now. So, you know, all these people, they crop up and say hello. It's lovely.
Look, we'll take your fourth track, shall we? And then we'll come back and talk about how you came eventually to retirement. That's a little bit further along. This is James Taylor, Up on the Roof.
Yeah, I mean, lovely, smoothy singer. What a good... I got all his LPs at home and things, you know, from years and years ago. And this is I think that's a great version of it.
Okay, let's have it.
When this old world starts a-getting me down, and people are just too much for me to face, I'll climb way up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares just drift right into space.
That's James Taylor with a lovely version of Up on the Roof there from 1979. A little bit more mellow, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that's chosen by Bonnie Sartin of the Yetis fame. And Bonnie, we've talked about the heyday of the group and how it came then, your overseas tours, and then how the folk clubs started to decline. But you were still recording and you were making appearances wherever they wanted to see you. But it came to a point where you began to think, well, how much longer shall we go on?
Yeah, I mean, I've driven down the A303 at 2 o'clock in the morning so many times the novelty was wearing off. And the other two, I'm a couple of years older, but the other two were creeping up to 65. And we thought, yeah, we've done 50 years, you know, that's quite long enough. Goodness knows any miles, you know, we've done in that time. And it seemed a natural way of doing things, really. And we were all very happy with that decision, I think, that it was time to call it a day.
But you decided that some time in advance. You didn't just come to
No. Everything was very slow. Like, even when Bob left the band, he gave us a year's notice.
Right.
You know, it's very Dorset.
Yes.
Yeah, we don't make instant decisions.
Very
you
civilized.
Mull it over for quite a long time, Terry. No. No, it's one of those things. We planned it, obviously, some time in advance, and we had this plan, this final fling in Sherborne.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was a lovely occasion. People even came from South Africa for that one, which is it's very humbling, actually, to be honest with you. And of course, they were all up for it. My grandson at the time was 18 months old, and he came along the audience clapping and, hey, granddad's on stage, you know. It was a lovely occasion. And then, you know, this farewell thing on the Sunday afternoon with everybody having a cup of tea and a slice of apple cake or whatever they fancied, and courtesy of Oxford's Bakery. And it was a bit of a tearjerker, really, but, you know, we felt we'd done the right thing. And
lots of music, I imagine, that day, wasn't it?
Yes.
And your last album was some years before that, wasn't it? 2005, was it?
I can't remember the exact date to me. I'll ramble away. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I see.
Which is a mix of traditional songs and other things that we picked up here and there and things I'd written. You know, it just... A nice mix of our usual Yetis material, really.
But with 55 albums, the Yetis legacy lives on, doesn't it? And will do for many years to come.
Yeah, well, hopefully. There's people come up and chat. Oh, I saw you in, let's see, was it 1976 in Barnsley Civic Hall and all that sort of thing, you know. Yeah, there's lots of fond memories out there.
And what about you since then? What have you been up to?
Oh, well, I'm chasing grandchildren, basically, but also singing a few songs for different people. I do whatever comes along. Can I plug my concerts?
Do, by all means.
There's two in November. The first one is on the 11th of November on Armistice Day. It's in Yetminster Village Hall at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There's a lovely chap from Stoford, Major Nick Speakman, who researches about the chaps that went off to the First World War from the village of Yetminster, and talks about them and what happened to them. And then I do the second half, which is songs and poems and bits of chat, mainly written by the troops, actually. That's the second half. And, of course, you know, it's not all cuddly stuff, some of it. And I've written one or two things myself for it, you know, because the things I had to put up with, all the rats and what have you, you know. So, yes.
And you do things with the U3A as well, I think, don't you?
Well, I'm leading a walk for the U3A next Thursday. Mm-hmm. But also in 17th of November, I'm doing a show at the little church, Holness Church, the other side of Long Burton, to raise money for that. and that with John Bullock, who lives in Sherborne, very good guitarist and singer. So that'll be, it's called Forever Dorset. So it'll be lots of Dorset material because we're a bit biased, to be honest with you. Yeah, so that'll be.
And I imagine you get called upon to do various public speaking and to come and do radio shows telling us about the,
well,
your
yeah,
life.
And I say I do whatever comes along because it's fun, isn't it? And it keeps, I tell you what, keeps the grey cells ticking over because I'm past my sell-by date, really, but I do enjoy it.
And cycling is a big part of
cycling
your life.
And walking and gardening and all those different
keep
things.
Keep fitting,
you know,
in that way.
Of course. I just picked my grapes last week. Oh, I've got about 5 gallons of wine bubbling away. If anyone wants a drop, come round about February time.
Bonnie, it's been great chatting to you. We're coming up towards the end of the interview, and we wish you well with whatever life now takes you in whatever direction you go.
Thank you very much.
The 11th of November.
Yes, in Yetminster. In Yetminster. Village Hall, yeah.
Tell us about your final track, which is another Yetties one, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. We recorded this in Millwall Port, in the old school there in the studio, and this was a time I wrote this for one of the oil crisis. Times, and because we got oil at Witch Farm down in near Wareham, and so it was, yeah, okay, we're all right, we've got oil, and so we had so much fun recording this, you would not believe. It was absolutely hilarious.
Bonnie Sarton, many thanks for coming in.
Absolute pleasure.
Lots of lovely oil, and when we dug it out the ground, we'll all live like a royal. Declare you the
UDI as well.
And tell them up in Parliament they can go the shell.
The seeds of prosperity for Dorset have been sown. The county motto has been changed to "Well, oil be blown." We knock back the caviar and eat enormous steaks. Our dairy farmers have become the very first milkshakes.
We've got oil, lots of lovely oil, and when we dug it out the ground, we'll all live like the royal. Declare UDI.
Right, UDI as well.
That's right.
And tell them up in Parliament they can go to Shell.
Farmer went exploring with his grace and fit to have to say the place he chose was by the old cesspit. What he found, I cannot tell. The answer's far too rude. Suffice to say that on that day, up come bubbling crude.
We've got oil, lots of lovely oil, and when we dug it out the ground, we'll all live like a royal. Declare UDI.
UDI as well.
And tell them up in Parliament, they can go to Shell.
We're buying up the breweries, we're buying up the pink. We'll put the squeeze on bankers till they all go skint. Cider will be free of charge, no one will have the toil. And then when we've achieved all that, we'll buy it from Ewing Oil.
We've got oil, lots of lovely oil, and when we dug it out the ground, we'll all live like a royal. Declare UDI.
Oh, UDI as well.
Oh, wow. And tell them up in Parliament they can go to Shell. We've got oil, lots of lovely oil, and when we dug it out the ground, we'll all live like a royal. Declare UDI.
And UDI as well.
And tell them up in Parliament they can go to Shell.
Splash.
We've got oil, lots of lovely oil, and when we dug it out the ground,